Hi, everybody. It's George from the George and Tony Entertainment Show, right here on the Realm Network. Tony has finally taken his PMP exam this week, so we're wishing him good luck. And in his absence, I get to talk to author George Corey. George's new book called Comic Book Fever is coming out in late June from Tomorrow's Publishing. George has also written books for Tomorrow's, including The Extraordinary Works of Alan Moore and Komoda, The Miracle Man Companion. He has also written articles and edited content for the plethora of periodicals and publications from Tomorrow's. Comic Book Fever is a celebration of comics published between 1976 and 1986. It's filled with great artwork and great interviews from creators of the time. If you're a fan of Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Harvey Comics, Archie Comics, if you're interested in the history of comics, or you're just feeling nostalgic about those days when you used to go to the local convenience store and were able to sample stuff off the spinner rack, why don't you give us a listen this week and get your geek on? You never know who you'll meet or what you'll learn on the George and Tony Entertainment Show, a proud part of the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to writer Mark Clark, the author of Star Wars FAQ, Everything Left to Know About the Trilogy That Changed the Movies. It's a vital backgrounder for anyone who just can't get enough about Han, Luke, Leia, the Wookiee, and the rest. Stick around. This is the book you're looking for. If there is nothing else in life I have to brag about, it's that I was in attendance at the Lowe's Astor Plaza Cinema in Manhattan for the red carpet world premiere of Star Wars in 1977. My buddy Bob Pinaha and I took a suburban bus in from New Brunswick, New Jersey that evening. Classy, huh? And it was one of the single most amazing film-going experiences of my lifetime. Unlike today, when the internet over-prepares us for every twist and turn that lies ahead in new movies, we had no idea what this Star Wars thing was about, or even why we were invited. And if we realized it would be as grand a night as it was, I suspect we both would have been dressed better. I, for one, had never been in a movie theater with escalators before. Or 70mm prints. And they gave out free popcorn and programs to everybody. And yes, I still have the program. When the film started and it felt like the place was going to explode from the noise of the ship seemingly passing overhead, we knew our lives would never be the same. Now, I must have seen Star Wars a few dozen times as summer turned to fall and spring. I remember driving my date, Carol Berger, to Paramus, New Jersey, the day I got my driver's license that October, so she could experience the movie in 70mm, just as I had in New York City. One slight problem: I didn't know how to get to Paramus from North Brunswick, New Jersey. Well, we figured that out. Of course, you got to understand, I'd never been on the Turnpike. I'd never been on the Garden State Parkway. I just literally got my license, maybe even the same day. And there were no maps. I had no map. I had no cell phone. GPS hadn't been invented yet, as far as I was concerned. And getting home took hours. So, yes, Star Wars is very, very important in my life. And while I don't cosplay as an Imperial Stormtrooper or wear Star Wars underoos anymore, or plan my life around Force Friday, okay, scratch that last one, I did that, I know plenty of people who do. Which is why my guest today is Mark Clark, author of Star Wars FAQ, Everything Left to Know About the Trilogy That Changed the Movies. The book has all the things we've come to enjoy in the FAQ series: clear-eyed perspective, deep history, and of course, memorable quotes, parodies, and ridiculous movie flubs. Interestingly, I thought, Clark is also the author of two books from the other Star universe: Star Trek FAQ, Everything Left to Know About the First Voyages of the Starship Enterprise, and Star Trek FAQ 2.0, Everything Left to Know About the Generation, the Next Generation, the Movies, and Beyond. Mark Clark, thank you for enduring that, and welcome to Mr. Media.
Happy to be here.
Listen, when I read these books, these FAQ books, which I get a kick out of, I'm personally compelled to skip to the end for what you call in this edition, sorry for the mess. These are the flubs and the gaffes found in the original Star Wars trilogy. Does that make me a bad guy for skipping right to that part?
Actually, these books, the ones that I've written anyway, are designed so you can kind of read them in whatever order you like. They're not intentionally supposed to be read front to back. You can dip in and out of them at will, according to whatever you know, if you want to read about the Star Wars holiday special first, you can go right to that, you know, whatever floats your boat. Generally, the Star Wars book is structured so that you want to read the parts that have to do with the individual movies in order, but beyond that, feel free to jump around all you want. It's fine.
Okay, and by the way, I did read in the holiday special stuff that Carrie Fisher song. Boy, that was a great one, wasn't it?
How did she miss the Grammy?
I don't know. Maybe she'll make up for it next year. So your feelings are not hurt that I skip right to the part that makes it a less than perfect film
or nope.
films?
Nope.
All right. So but here's the question. If the Star Wars films are masterpieces, how can there be all these continuity and other mistakes? Does it detract from our enjoyment or does it enhance it?
Well, it's long been my belief as a film critic and even as a fan that perfection is overrated. You know, there's a certain kind of sterility and, it's just kind of off-putting if everything's absolutely perfect. And so little imperfections can be endearing, and they just also – nothing with a lot of energy tends to be perfect. You know, nothing with a lot of just raw power and originality tends to be perfect because it's a little rough on the edges, you know, when you are birthing something new and different and fresh and original. And so the things that tend to be most exciting in a lot of cases are also, you know, a little flawed. You don't have many Citizen Kanes out there, you know, a first time that's just letter perfect. Practically, even Citizen Kane has the weird, you know, cockatoo, you know, error problem with it in the one shot. But the energy that you get from a first experience like Star Wars more than makes up for any flaws that are in the work. So, and a lot of times, as I talk about the flaws in Star Wars, there are things that most viewers wouldn't even think about or notice when they're watching the movie, and certainly didn't in 1977. But if you watch a movie a few dozen times or more, then you begin to pick up on these little inconsistencies and problems.
And Star Wars, and I'm thinking like the first Planet of the Apes movie, something that I'd also saw many, many times when it came out, and I was a bit younger, you do watch these movies over and over and over and over again. They really don't get old. I mean, and they hold up to repeat. And as a matter of fact, talking about things that change the movie industry, the idea that you would put out a movie that people would come back to 10 and 15 times, that changed the film industry.
Absolutely. That was the real key to Star Wars earning as much money as it did, and also generating as much sort of merchandising sales and with, you know, T-shirts and soundtrack albums and all that business, was people just couldn't get enough of Star Wars, and they would see the movie over and over again. And in certain areas where you didn't have the opportunity to see, or like me, I only saw the movie actually five times when it was in its original release. And I waited 6 months to see it, which I write about in the introduction to the book. But, if I'd seen it sooner, maybe I would have seen it more times. But, you know, I didn't grow up with a truckload of money, and they didn't live really near a movie theater. And so it was a little bit harder for me to get out and see it. So I made do with, like, the Story of Star Wars record album and the novelization and the comic books. And I read those things over and over again and played the record till the grooves were practically wore off of it, in addition to going to the movie, you know, close to a half dozen times. So people did what they had to do, but they just could not get enough Star Wars, especially in 77, 78.
Well, I'd just like to add, when I saw the world premiere, I saw it for free. I did have to pay for my bus ticket.
I envy you for seeing it in 70. I didn't get to see it in 70.
Oh, it was incredible. It completely changed my life. I mean, I wound up studying film in college, and I think that had something to do with it. Film studies, not film production. But, you know, once you've seen once you've seen 70 millimeter print of something, I mean, it's really hard to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, going from an old, you know, tube television to a flat screen that's, you know, 48 inches or 60. I mean, it's just...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen other things in 70. I saw Lawrence of Arabia in 70.
Oh, that'd be great.
Saw Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade in 70 and some other things, but I unfortunately didn't get to see Star Wars yet. Who knows? Maybe they'll reissue it someday. Probably not.
It could happen, you know. If the movie opens as huge as everyone thinks it will in December, who knows how many times they're going to reissue the originals. I mean, and they'll probably put out 4, 5, and 6 again and, you know, hopefully skip 1, 2, and 3 since the continuity is more with these with this new one, I guess. One more question about the flubs and stuff. How do you know about them? I mean, for example, the one I saw, and I don't, maybe I'd heard this one before, but I got a kick out of reading it. Let's say again, was Peter Mayhew's the bottom of his sneaker being visible as Chewbacca is running? I mean, where do you?
That's a hilarious one.
That's good.
I mean, it's just one of those things that if you watch the movie closely many times, or are the kind of person who occasionally would watch shot by shot, or even, you know, sort of you just kind of click through it really slowly to look at the way things are constructed and put together, then it's easier to pick up on these things. I mean, in some cases, you have to really watch a film in a way that most normal human beings never would. But Star Wars is the kind of movie that inspires a following that's willing to experience it every way possible, including frame by frame. And I've certainly, you know, tried to look at sequences and break things down, and you just stumble across things that are like, you know, did he really just bang his head on the door, you know, coming into the control room? And then, of course, there are now these websites, Movie Mistakes, for example, that kind of aggregate, you know, everyone's posts about the different flubs and things that people have found in the movie. So that makes it a lot easier. Back in the day, you just had to watch the movie over and over again on videotape or whatever you had.
Videotape, that would have been hard to start and stop. We know that. It's not like the DVD.
Rewind,
be kind. Or be kind, rewind. That's another movie. Another chapter I find irresistible in your book, as I have in some of the others in the series, is Luke, I Am Your Father, the quotable and misquotable Star Wars. Personally, I just want to say personally, I think George Lucas needs to re-edit The Empire Strikes Back so that Luke actually says, so that Darth Vader actually says to Luke, I am your father, Luke, which is what we all think in our heads that he said, but it's not what he said. Are you with me on this, or
absolutely? You know, and they could totally dub that in. You don't have to worry about his mouth moving. So,
right.
You know, why not? You know, it's like adding back in, play it again, Sam, or, you know, Elementary, my dear Watson. Why not throw it in? You know,
you have those examples in the book of things that we think were said but were not said.
Right.
All right. So, are there any? Okay, we know the great lines, particularly from the original trilogy. These are not the droids you're looking for, and all that kind of stuff. Did I get that one right? Because that's what I've been saying for years.
I believe that is correct, yes.
Okay. But are there any great lines? And I know your book is about the first three movies, but are there any great lines in the second trilogy? I can't think of one.
The end.
Touche. I know
the prequel movies have their fans, and there are, you know, there are things to enjoy in all the Star Wars movies, but I don't happen to be a fan of those films. I think that comes across in my book. I'm among those who just felt a little sort of let down by those movies, and I am holding out hope for the new films, but I was not overly impressed with those. So,
right, well,
yeah, most of the dialogue in those films I've tried to sort of, you know, blot out. So,
Mark Clark, the day this posts on the internet, I award you win the internet for saying the end. I there's nothing I'm going to say the rest of the interview that's going to top that. I almost feel like I need to quit now. We talked a little about this already, but I mean, one of the most important impacts that Star Wars movies have had on Hollywood is the mind-blowing multi-million-dollar merchandise tie-ins. And I think there's even been some movies are created, like Transformers, are initially created just to make the tie-in money, and others, you know, that come into being because someone thinks we'll make the money on the toys. Who cares if the movie's any good? Am I overstating the case?
No, I mean, I think that's fair. There were blockbuster hits before Star Wars, not as big. And there were even films that had a lot of merchandising around them, like the Disney movies, for example. But Star Wars was just next level on all of that. It was box office like the industry had never seen. And then the merchandising revenue was completely unprecedented, the scale of it. And the breadth of it, the number of products, and there's a whole chapter on that in the book too about, the way it impacted things like the fate of different toy companies and just the multitude of products that were available, and no one had seen anything like that before. So the other studios all wanted to get into this business of coming up with a franchise with this built-in marketing, bonanza potential. And I think that really drove the kinds of movies that were made in the wake of Star Wars and that are still made today with the superhero movies and everything, you know, lots of the other action films that we see these days are very much crafted with an idea toward merchandising and video games and all these other pieces as a sort of a full spectrum array of economic potential from the jump, you know, and smaller films that don't have that kind of tie-in potential just aren't what anybody has been looking for since. I write in the book about how there was this kind of some people view as a sort of a golden age of movie science fiction after 2001 and before Star Wars, where you had more thoughtful a lot of the sort of dystopian movies, including George Lucas's THX-1138. And so there were these very smart movies that wrestled with all kinds of political, philosophical issues during that period of time. And they all kind of got forgotten about once Star Wars came out and showed this whole other model of doing business. You know, like I say in the book, no one was looking for, you know, Soylent Green, you know, after Star Wars. And nobody was going to be going and buying, you know, Soylent Green action figures or whatever. So it was just, then we got Superman and we got, you know, the Alien and Predator and these other movies that had much more potential as toys and video games and all this other jazz that wasn't really directly related to the movie, but was sort of essential to what Hollywood wanted in terms of a product. And that's really, we're still in that business. The thing that's interesting to me about it and why the book is called How Star Wars Changed the Movies is I really think Star Wars is that key moment where Hollywood finds a new business model. I write about how the old business model, the classic Hollywood Dream Factory studio system model, where Hollywood owned, you know, the studio and the distribution company and the theater chains, that got struck down in the late 40s. And it took, when the television came in, and Hollywood really struggled for a period of a couple of decades, especially in the 60s, to sort of figure out how it was going to operate. And you had the new Hollywood model where you were hiring young filmmakers to do films that wouldn't cost very much but could potentially make big returns, like, you know, Easy Rider and things like that. And that worked for a while, but then they were never really totally comfortable with that model as an industry. And Star Wars really showed us this model of the huge blockbuster film that sort of fuels everything else. It pushes so much revenue into the studio coffers that it can fund everything else that you want to do. And that's the model we've been in ever since. And that model, at this point, has actually been around longer than the old classic Hollywood Dream Factory, you know, model of filmmaking even. It's been the most enduring, for better or worse, it's been the most enduring way that Hollywood has operated so far and doesn't show any immediate signs of changing.
Now, when we started this conversation, I skipped right to the fun parts of the book. But I want to go back to sort of the beginning. For people who may have actually joined the Star Wars Revolution late, hard to imagine anyone was born after Star Wars started, but apparently there have been people. So I like that you give it context. You talk about, and you mentioned THX 1138. In the book, you describe Lucas's life before the Death Star. You go through some of the iterations of the original script. And you talk about the movies that kind of influenced his creation and perspective of Star Wars. I wonder if maybe you could just take a minute. You can have 2 minutes if you like, and just kind of give people who are kind of young and new to this a little background on what this was all about, but where it all stems from.
Well, really, what Lucas wanted to do first was to do a remake of Flash Gordon, the serials from the 1930s based on the Alex Raymond comic strips, which were sort of the first real space opera, spaceships and aliens and monsters and ray guns and all that business that Hollywood had produced. And he loved those films. He especially loved the Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe, which is the third of the three serials that Universal made featuring Flash Gordon. And he wanted to make a Flash Gordon movie, but he couldn't get the rights to it. The Dino De Laurentiis, an Italian producer, owned the rights to it already. They had already purchased the rights. So he was forced to sort of come up with his own story. And then in interviews, Lucas has said later that was sort of a blessing in disguise, because he was able to come up with something ultimately that he felt was, I also feel it was better, and certainly was more profitable for him, because he could own the characters. Hang on.
Okay.
Sorry, power cord issue. Anyway, the other key piece, so you've got Flash Gordon, and what you get with Lucas is you've got Flash Gordon, and then you get the influence of the Japanese master Akira Kurosawa with movies like The Hidden Fortress, which was a particularly strong influence on Lucas. So he's bringing these sort of very pop, science fiction fun type of concepts and blending them with this sort of art house, international samurai sort of vibe to come up with this very fresh mixture of elements that was not quite like anything else we'd ever seen before.
Another thing that I really liked in the book is that while most people think of Star Wars as being George Lucas and the three main actors, you give some attention to some of the behind-the-scenes people, who, and some of them, particularly John Dykstra, who composed all the themes, music, and of course, special effects master Rick Baker. It's nice that you give a little attention to those people. I mentioned two of the most well known of that group. Is there one other person you think people should know because of his work, his or her work?
I really think that I have a section in the book that's sort of about underappreciated contributors. One guy I think doesn't get enough. Well, two. I'll give you two. How about that?
Sure.
I don't think Gary Kurtz, who was the producer of the first two films, and gets maybe as much credit as he should, because he later had a falling out with Lucas and has sort of been diminished in the official histories. But he was right there with George, if I may call him George, from the very beginning. Sitting out in a restaurant where Lucas first said, "Hey, I want to make this Flash Gordon movie." To being involved with casting and shooting locations or selecting locations and just doing all manner of things to help really help those films along and to help Lucas put his vision on the screen. And he also collaborated with Lucas on American Graffiti, which is Lucas's other really truly great movie. And I just don't think he gets as much credit as he deserves. And the other person who is celebrated, but maybe it doesn't immediately roll off the tongue, is Ralph McQuarrie, who was a production artist And which typically you hire those guys when you're like, well, I've got this idea. I want to help people understand what I'm talking about. So I'm going to hire somebody to draw what I'm talking about so other people can see it. And what McQuarrie did was a little bit different than that, because Lucas himself was having trouble figuring out what he wanted. And in a lot of cases, McQuarrie would sort of help direct him and come up with an image or an idea for how a character or a spaceship or a setting or something should look. And he would draw it or paint it. And it would not only helped Lucas sell the movie to 20th Century Fox, but also helped him sort of envision it himself. And many of the characters, you know, Chewbacca, the droids, Darth Vader, look the way they look because of the way that Ralph McQuarrie drew them. And much of the Star Wars universe looks the way that it does because it's the way that McQuarrie envisioned it. And so, I mean, he does get a lot of respect, but I think his influence is probably bigger than people think. Oh, and another person. I'll go for three. I'll go for the trifecta today.
All right.
Marcia Lucas, Marcia Griffith, George's first wife, I think probably was a bigger influence as a sounding board for Lucas, and also as somebody who was willing to tell him that his ideas were stupid when they were stupid, and rein him in a little bit. And I think that the prequel trilogy, which we were talking about later, which was made after after George and Marcia Lucas had divorced, one of the things they really lack, in my opinion, is anybody to put any kind of rein on Lucas. He does everything himself and does everything he wants to do just the way he wants to do it, even when in some cases it maybe wasn't the best way to do things. And there's just nobody there to try to tell him, that's a dumb idea. Why don't we do this instead? And she was able to do that. And I think that in and of itself was a valuable contribution that often gets overlooked. And she was a great editor. And in fact, won an Oscar for editing, among other people, for editing Star Wars.
Well, and I think that was the Star Wars, particularly the first movie, was one of those times where people who never cared about behind the scenes on movies took an interest and made, there were cults that developed around some of these other people, like, McQuarrie and Dykstra and people like that, Rick Baker, who, previously they just toiled in anonymity for the most part. Maybe not Dykstra, but, suddenly these guys and Marcia, they were brand names. Their names meant something. Their work meant something that the average person didn't know before.
There are interviews with like guys that worked in the model shop, who are just gluing together the little, X-Wings and TIE Fighters and stuff, who later, once people found out they had worked on Star Wars, people would ask them for their autograph. And it just didn't matter what you did. If you worked on the movie in any capacity, everybody, wanted to work with you or wanted to, be connected with you in some way. So, yeah, that was a real thing. Absolutely.
All right. So we've gone from really high quality behind the scenes craftsmen to I'm going to take issue with something you say in the book. In an early chapter, you address the many imitative films that followed the first Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I take issue with your assessment of just one. Do you know which one that is? Take a guess.
Star Crash.
No, I never saw that. Sounds like a piece of star crap. No, not that one. Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, okay.
I actually thought that was kind of fun. It was, you go in knowing it's Roger Corman, it's cheap, but it was just a fun movie. No, it doesn't hold up to Star Wars, but it was just kind of a fun movie, I always thought. Richard Thomas is,
The thing with Battle Beyond the Stars that really, I think, is difficult for me is that it comes kind of late. We've had a lot of other Star Wars, pseudo Star Warses or, ersatz of Star Warses in the meantime. And it also has the misfortune of having the same idea, which is to do the Seven Samurai in outer space, which we had already seen in Message from Space, several years earlier. And it's not, you know, I mean, it's kind of fun. You know, I actually like, you know, just to sit and watch. It's a fun movie to watch. I actually like Star Crash. I think it's a lot of fun, especially with the right beverages. Message from Space is another one that's kind of fun. The ones that are really dreadful are things like H.G. Wells' Shape of Things to Come, and some of the other ones that are just really hard to get through. Some of the Italian things are really hard to get through. But there is a certain kind of goofy charm to Battle Beyond the Stars, and I wouldn't begrudge it that. But it's just coming that late and with as much, you know, relative to Corman, you know, with as much money and resources they put into that movie, I just wish they had come up with a little bit better scenario. It just seemed a little tired to me.
To me, it was fun in the same way that the Corman Fantastic Four movie, which was done for like $1 million, is fun. It's just like, yeah, at that point in history, you have much higher expectations of a Star Wars-type movie or a Marvel superhero movie. But, you know, there's something about it that's just kind of earnest and fun. It's kind of silly. I don't know. And I think I like Battle Beyond the Stars the same reason I like Galaxy Quest, which had more money and was better done. But it was still just kind of a goof on the medium, you know.
I love Galaxy Quest.
Yeah,
I'm with you on that one.
Okay, all right. I'll let you off the hook there. So you have done several books in this FAQ series, the Star Trek books. What's the appeal? Are they fun to do? Are they challenging to do?
Both, okay. Actually. These are both Star Wars, you know, again, as I write about in the book, like you, was very meaningful for me, made a huge dent on my psyche when I was 11 years old, and I never have fully recovered in certain ways from that. And so it's just fun to be able to kind of revisit that and delve into sort of, you know, these books are fun for me in part because it gives me the opportunity to really take some time to dig into subjects that I am passionate about, and I get to learn a lot, and that's always fun. And then, you know, and again, the Star Wars and Star Trek both are things I have childhood connections with, which also makes them a little bit of extra emotional attachment to those.
So what's next? What are you working on next?
I have way more ideas for books than I will ever have time to actually write the books. I have about a half dozen nonfiction things that are in various stages, but I don't have anything in contract right now. And in the meantime, I had kind of I was out of contract for a period of time between delivering the second Star Trek book and the first and the Star Wars book, and I actually started a novel, young adult science fiction novel, which is almost finished. So I've decided to go ahead and finish that, see if it goes anywhere, and then move on to one of the half dozen other book ideas that I have, nonfiction book ideas I have. But I want to kind of get this out of the way first, and then I'll move on to that. And I don't want to. I would tell you what it was if I had a contract, but I don't want to go out there with a contract yet.
No,
so it'll be something. It'll be cool. Trust me.
Oh, good, good. Well, and I wouldn't let you tell us about something that's not under contract and protected by copyright. That wouldn't be right. So, folks, listen. You can order Mark Clark's new filmography, Star Wars FAQ, Everything Left to Know About the Trilogy That Changed the Movies, from great retailers everywhere, or you can get it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you are watching this show or listening to the show at MrMedia.com, then you can probably look a little below the video or the audio player, and you will see the cover of Mark's book. Click on it. It'll take you to Amazon. They can get you the book, the physical book, in 30 minutes or less via drone. Subject to certain areas and whether the technology really truly exists, I don't know. But if not, you can have it in a day or two, I promise. I swear to you, you can have it in a day or two. Mark, do you have a website? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of those things?
I'm on Facebook. You can go to I have a page, and then you can also go to Star Wars FAQ Book as its own Facebook page.
Okay.
So, and I try to upload things there. In terms of various content, a lot of it's content that I refer to in the book, but, you know, like various like TV appearances from the 70s and things like that that I write about in the book. You can actually view those things online if you want to endure that.
That sounds very cool. And is there a special way to find Mark Clark that would be you on Facebook?
That's a good question.
Are you Mark Clark 56173 or something?
I don't know. I think just go to the Star Wars book page and you can find me from there.
That sounds good. All right, very good. Well, Mark, it was fun reading the book. Delightful to have you here today. Good luck with the next book, whatever it may be. And thank you for joining us on Mr. Media.
Anytime.
Is recorded live before a studio audience full of unused characters from the first six movies, cartoons, and comic books, hoping for one more shot at the silver screen in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. All right, so